Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Anne Lamott, whose latest novel is Imperfect Birds. This novel follows with the same characters as two earlier novels, Rosie and Crooked Little Heart. Anne Lamott is also the author of several nonfiction works, collections of essays, the most recent of which is Grace Eventually, Thoughts on Faith. Anne Lamott, what brought you back to these characters after this amount of time, knowing that if this were real time, the character of Rosie would be close to 30 now?
Yeah, that's right. Well, luckily it's not real time, whatever Einstein would make of our insistence that even such a thing exists. But I started the first Rosie in 1980, so yeah, she was a little girl in that book, and then she's 13 and 14 in the second book of the trilogy, Crooked Little Heart. And one thing that brought me back was that I've just always loved these characters. And I kind of wanted to see what Rosie was up to. And I wanted to see the effects of what she was up to on the marriage of her mother, Elizabeth, and James.
Well, when you talk about want to see what she's up to, for you, what exactly does that mean?
Well, she's a little bit older. And my experience in the Bay Area, and specifically Marin, is that when they're a little bit older, they start to get into more at-risk behavior. I had a son who's 20 now, whose friends at 15, 16, 17 were doing some really dangerous stuff with drugs and sexual acting out, and, of course, a lot of the same stuff we did in the 60s and 70s, but the stakes are higher and the drugs are better and the prescription drugs are much more rampant and sophisticated. And the girls have really lost a lot of that teaching and healing of the women's movement and regressed into the habit of hooking up, which is, of course, servicing guys at parties, sometimes serially and sometimes not, but with nothing in return and no reciprocation. And so I wanted to see what somebody who I think is as brilliant and really unique and gifted in many ways as Rosie would do in the face of the pressure to get into the greatest college and later that week hook up with the cutest guy.
Did you always have it in the back of your mind that you would return to these characters?
No, but I felt it was a little bit leaving everybody in the dark when Rosie at the end of Crooked Little Heart is only 14. Her best friend has had a child and moved away, and Rosie's really come through some very deep, difficult lessons. And her mother, Elizabeth, who's an equal character in these books, has finally gotten to the grief of having lost her husband when Rosie was 5. Elizabeth, paradoxically, is on a trampoline, bouncing higher and higher and higher when she breaks down. I did want to find out what it was like for these two women 3 or 4 years later.
Well, there is one big difference, and that's that these first two books were written before your son was born, and now he is more or less the same age, give or take, as Rosie, or the same generation as Rosie suddenly, mm-hmm. which means there's got to be some bleed through of your own feelings as a parent that were not necessarily there in the earlier books.
Well, that's true. I didn't have a child when I wrote Rosie, and I relied on a lot of interviews. I relied on a lot of interviews with 16, 17, 18-year-old girls for Imperfect Birds, too, because I know what it's like to be an alcoholic, drug-using girl of 17 in the late 60s and early 70s, but I really don't know what that means in the modern era with ecstasy and OxyContin and all the ADD and ADHD drugs that the kids pass out, the Adderall and the Ritalin. The main difference for me between this last book and the first two is also I got sober in 1986 when I started to become able to be a writer more in command of her work.
Also, Elizabeth has gotten sober, too, and she's dealing with those issues as her child grows up, which I would guess, in a way, even though the instances are different, parallels your relationship with your son.
Yeah, but difference, I think, is that I've been sober 24 years, and Elizabeth has been sober really off and on, and this last time not for very long. Rosie grew up with an alcoholic mother. She's seen her mother very drunk as a child and a young child, and she's seen her fairly recently lying on the floor of the bathroom drunk again. My son's never seen me drunk or high, and that's a huge influence on the sense of safety and self that a child comes into.
Anne Lamott, the book itself, you've said that there are certain themes, and one of the themes that you talk about is how difficult it is to know and to communicate with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering, when you're writing a book like this, does the mere writing of it help you in terms of your communication with your son?
No, I don't think necessarily. But I also started this book when Sam was 18 and had already moved out of the house and was really on his own 2 feet and really a young man. But it's actually a very good question. I wrote one piece that was a very important piece in terms of our communication. It's 2006, so it's a while ago now, and it's the piece in Grace Eventually where I crossed a line that will haunt me forever when I lost my mind with Sam's contemptuous, cold, just general loathsomeness, and I slapped him. And the piece I wrote for Salon, as I wrote most of these pieces, was difficult to write, and like with everything, I asked Sam if it was okay to tell the story, because it ends up with a lot of grace notes in it, which is to say that I slapped him at the end of my rope, at physically out in the parking lot, not parking lot, our house isn't out, what are they called, driveway, that's right, now I remember. By later that afternoon, we were both taking naps in the same room on separate couches in my living room, and I woke up and looked at him, and I thought, you can't get from where we were at noon to where we are now, what happened? And when I wrote it, I showed it to Sam, I always show him everything I've written about him. And he thrust it back at me and said, you can't run this. You make me seem like the bad guy. And he said, this was a story where both of us behaved really badly. And I wrote it again and I wrote it again. And then, you know, people have always said, how does Sam feel about being written about? Well, no one could ever be more proud of me than Sam. And when he was at 18 going to a community college in Washington State. And I was speaking at an auditorium at, I think, the University of Washington at Spokane. And I said, why don't you bring some friends? He brought 20 friends who filled the front row. And I said to him before I went on, I'm taking requests tonight. What do you want to hear? And he said, read the Heat piece. He said, I think it's the best thing you've ever written.
You're not writing for Salon anymore, are you?
Sometimes I am. If I am not writing for anyone, really, but I do write pieces for Salon from time to time when something sort of tugs on my sleeve and I think it's really important politically to write it.
Another theme that you talk about when you're talking about the book is Elizabeth's torn loyalties,
mm-hmm.
in terms of being loyal to Rosie, and then Rosie herself, who's getting involved with drugs and is hiding things from Elizabeth. Elizabeth's husband understands this and sees this more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of your own relationship with your son, I would guess that that sort of loyalty played a role too. I mean, you always want to be loved and you always want to remain loyal, but sometimes you have to be the bad guy.
You do. If you're a good parent, you have to be the bad guy. I wasn't married when Sam was a teenager. I was with a man all those years, but I didn't feel that deep sense of tornness because I wasn't married that Elizabeth feels, because she loves Rosie more than life itself, but James is a close second. She's so desperate to be loved, as many, many parents of teenagers are, and I certainly was, that you overlook stuff, you let stuff slide, and you also work it out in your mind that it really doesn't mean what it seemed to at first, which was cause her panic. Elizabeth wants to be Rosie's friend, and that's her greatest challenge, because we are not here to be our children's friends. When we're being their friends and having that be a core value, we're doing damage to the kids. We're here to be their parents. And so that is something that over the course of 300 pages, Elizabeth is struggling with, how to be willing to tolerate her child not loving her, being not thinking she's a good mother anymore, not speaking to her. It's absolutely awful. I know that firsthand from experiences when Sam hated me or stopped speaking to me. You literally want to die.
My sister tended to try to be friends with her kids' friends, and the kids' friends are going, you can't do that. We need our privacy.
Sam's friends pretended that they did want to be friends, but the teenage system is absolute patriotic loyalty to their friends. That's what their lives are about, is getting away from you to be with their friends. Their friends are their life. And so if you think that you're a really close friend to your child's friends, it's a complete illusion, and they're you know, feeling sorry for you behind your back. And of course, they don't exactly want you to be their friend. They do want you to provide them with meals at any time they stop by. And because you don't know that you're not actually their friend, you're just cooking away and microwaving away. And it's pretty brutal when it turns out that they have a whole world that you are not a part of in any way, except as possibly the impediment to their lives and joy.
I keep thinking, as you're talking, of the situation that happened with me is that I had a group of friends I was very close with, five other guys in high school and shortly thereafter, and my parents spent a great deal of time, my father in particular, putting a wedge between me and them so that I had to make this choice that I wasn't in a position to make. My parents going, choose us, and of course my friends going, what the hell are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of kids fall into that, and it's difficult when you're a teenager.
I didn't have that in my experience. My parents' hands were pretty full, and I don't think that's something that comes up for Elizabeth and Rosie so much. Elizabeth loves her friends, but, you know, one's been to rehab. One has been taking Adderall for ever since she was a little girl. And so Elizabeth worries that she's giving it to Rosie because very nice speed, and the kids love it for study aids, especially around midterms and finals and big papers do. But Elizabeth actually really loves and enjoys these two friends, and I think the two friends genuinely appreciate Elizabeth. In my experience is some of Sam's friends I really am still close to, and this is 3 years after graduation, because if you're not their parent, that's about 90% of the struggle. You know, once you're not their parent, a lot of his friends have confided in me and do see me as sort of a safe house that they can tell me stuff or ask me stuff or run stuff by me that they would never in a million years tell their parents.
Anne Lamott, let's talk a little about your research on the book. Things that don't directly relate to you and your son. I had a long talk last night with one of my nephews who's 19 and is ADD and has been on drugs for a long time, and it's a real mess for him. I mean, he can't be off them too long because his schoolwork falls apart, and yet when he's on them, he has these periods where he's awake for 36 hours and sleeping for 16.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much of that you ran across in talking to these girls.
You know, I didn't run across that. What I found was that the girls just really enjoyed, rather than needed, the Adderall, that it was a part of a cocktail of drugs for them, that they were still getting the prescriptions, but it was no longer because they were really having to take it in order to be okay. They just really enjoyed it.
Well, when you're looking at your own memories of our generation, right, and then comparing it to these girls that you've spoken with, and also in a broader sense with your son's friends as well, beyond the fact that, as you've said, you know, the drugs are a little different and more dangerous now, perhaps, do you see any other major generational differences, or are teenagers just plain teenagers?
I think to pretty big extent, teenagers are teenagers. They're trying to individuate. They're trying to get their freedom. If you're a good parent, you've raised them so that you are to become dispensable, and that's just very painful as a parent. It's painful for a kid, too, but it's what they so desperately want. My experience, though, as I said a little earlier, is that when I was 16, the first issue of Ms. Magazine came out. That was really what defined me and a lot of the women in my generation was these wings that the magazine and the feminist movement gave us. It gave us our lives, really. And the 16-year-old girls now are certainly benefiting from all the work that we feminists did and all the ground we broke and the laws we got passed. But by the same token, you feel really like the movement never happened. You see these girls, and so many of them dress in what I call hooker wear, and that their value and definition is so defined by how the coolest, most popular guys in the crowd, who could be the guys with the best cocaine, feel about them. Rosie has a 4.2 average. I mean, she's an exceptional student, which is, I think, why it's so easy for Elizabeth to overlook the signs and indications that there's a drug problem, because she really is exceptional. A guy came to one of my readings last week, and he said, and he was a teacher at one of the schools in the district, and he said, in Marin, exceptional is the new norm, and I think that's really true. We were never under that kind of pressure to get into a handful of colleges that would either almost guarantee financial success after graduation or be able to give them scholarships that would mean during economic hard times that the kids could actually go to a four-year private university. So the pressure is very different, and the fact that the girls have, in some ways, regressed, have had the luxury of regressing back into this thing about looks and boobs and flat tummies and sexual prowess, is, I find it very disheartening.
You're listening to an interview with Anne Lamott, whose latest novel is Imperfect Birds. One thing I've noticed about this younger generation, at least the people that I've spoken with, is that in terms of school, we used to think of school as a place to learn. Now, the learning wasn't necessarily the classroom learning, but certainly in college it was going to see foreign films. It was talking until the wee hours about real issues. And what I'm noticing in talking to my nephew and other people of that generation is that that has disappeared. School is only about grades. There seems to be less bleed through of learning from the classroom into their lives. I don't know if that's something you've seen.
I don't know yet, because Sam's been in college a couple of years, and he's in an art academy, and he has just got such a deep focus. And Sam is a father now, too, and so he's got a nine-month-old and a full-time school life. He lives with his girlfriend and his little boy, but I know exactly what you mean. I mean, college was such a profound time of finding out about life, and maybe you majored in one thing, but you were just starving for, and you had a voracious appetite for what we would call at the time, and I think rightly so, truth. You wanted to know what it was all about, who you were, what it meant to be a human, how we were to live, what other cultures made of it, and just this thirst for all of these music and movies and anthropological stuff and archaeological stuff and poetry. And now the kids are really on these fast tracks. It's very strategic now. You go to a certain school, and it's pretty much laid out for you what the next 4 years are going to look like. In order to do this, you need to do pretty much exactly this. There's no time built in for flailing and flopping and staying up all night talking about, you know, Auden. Because what you've got is so many papers due. You know, the boys in Rosie's class can pick and choose which girl they want to be with. Because if one girl isn't going to do what they want, they just go on to another one. And in college, the colleges can really pick and choose. All of the kids applying have 4-point plus and perfect SAT scores. So they can really pick and choose. If you've got in, you're going to have to do it their way. It's, I think, overall what kids are experiencing now.
Anne Lamott, I'd like to change the subject and talk a little about your views on different issues that are happening today. It's been a while since Grace Eventually. When you look at the Tea Party situation, what do you think you're seeing?
Oh, my God. I keep remembering that great Shirley Jackson story, The Lottery. I have just nothing but kind of horror at the Tea Party and just amazement at the creation of Sarah Palin. I mean, I'm going to start sending her money, because I so hope she's a huge player in the 2012 presidential election. I think she is just an idiot. Now, I say that without judgment, but I can't stand to listen to her voice for a second. I was thrilled when John McCain was reduced to having her there on stage with him stumping and money raising, and that for her to say to his audience, we're all in the Tea Party now, and John McCain, I'm just one of those Christians with a mean streak, and I'm very glad for him to have been exposed to be the absolutely shameless, cynical, right-wing, anti-women, anti-gay man that he is. And I was always on to him. I want to say I never fell for that guy. I look at the Tea Party, and I see all those stories by Shirley Jackson and Huxley and all those prophetic stories, George Orwell. Not Orwell so much, but people collectively losing their mind, these straight, white, mostly male men trying to spiritualize their hysteria and insisting on the right to deny a whole lot of people their civil liberties under the guise of it being both in the Constitution and the Bible. I love this fundamentalist obsession with pouring through the Bible, trying to find new people to hate. The Tea Party, I think, has peaked. I probably think the same thing you think. I just think they're going to burn out on all that energy, because they're just, again, I say this without judgment, they're so stupid. And they're so wrong. And the guys that were there on the mall with their guns strapped to their legs saying, answering questions saying, well, yes, I do think we'd all be safer if everybody gathered today here on the mall had guns. Well, yeah, I don't think it matters whether it's a pistol or an automatic. It's our right under the Constitution. I'd be like, okay, thanks for sharing.
What do you think of Barack Obama so far?
He was not my first choice. I'm mortified to say that John Edwards was my first choice.
Mine too,
yeah.
At one point.
I felt very passionate about his two Americas and his fight for poverty, for the people who just experienced grinding poverty in this country. And then I was a huge Hillary Clinton fan, and I think I actually still think she's such a brilliant thinker and powerhouse. I think she's doing a great job as Secretary of State. And I love Obama. I did a lot of work trying to help him get elected, and I feel like he's going to be a great president. I can say, honestly, I wept when the House's reconciliation health care bill passed. I was amazed. I wept for my parents, who are old lefties and KPFA people. I wept for Teddy Kennedy. I raised my fist in the power salute. 32 million people. And of course, if I were God or in charge, which I think would be an excellent idea, it would have been single payer. But I wasn't ever going to get what I wanted. And I was amazed by what we did get. I'm disheartened by the offshore drilling. But I remember also a year ago, he warned us when he was saying that oil independence was going to be a national security matter from now on. And I thought, uh-oh. And he is a centrist. He's not he's not McGovern, you know. He's not Paul Wellstone. I think he's kind of a fascinating I think he's a brilliant guy, and I've just decided to trust him. And to me, the fact that that long national nightmare of those two Republican oilmen from Texas, pigs at the trough, is over makes me automatically in a good mood almost every day. I mean, I felt like we had lost the country, and I didn't know. I think what Obama inherited was a country as destroyed and reduced to rubble as right after the Civil War. And it's to me, everything that Obama is doing is a small miracle. The fact that his cabinet and his administration is staffed with profound and feminist women just makes me happy every single day. I pinch myself when I think about those little tiny thin women that Bush surrounded himself with, all blondes with little short hair, that would say, well, I can assure you that Mr. Bush considered the evidence that there were WMDs every single day before he made the decision to go to Iraq, Mr. Rude Mouth. And now I see these women who are the most brilliant and articulate people in America, and that they are making our laws, and they are speaking for the poor and the women and the children and the very old of America. They're making this country a place where it's safe to be a baby and a very old person again.
Anne Lamott, where do you get your news information from?
Everywhere. I'm really a junkie, probably just like you. I get it the same place as you do. Well, I read the New York Times, which I love, and I read the Chronicle, which some of my first memories are of my parents reading the paper at the breakfast table at 6 a.m. in the late 50s and early 60s. And so I have a very deep loyalty to the Chronicle, and I read the New York Times, and then I go online and I read The Washington Post, and then I read Talking Points Memo, and I read Salon every day, and I read Huffington Post. I kind of noodle around, and I read Politico, and, you know, I do have to try to get a little tiny bit of work done every day, which is very inconvenient, and I am a grandmother, which cuts into my noodling around the news time.
When working on Imperfect Birds and understanding that there's some kind of time element there, I noticed that there wasn't too much political because you wanted to keep that vague.
Yeah.
How easy or difficult was that to stay away from that and go, well, I have to keep this vague. I don't want anybody to know what year it is.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. I really am a political junkie, and that it's really my love, like other people's love might be music. Because the characters in this book would be 35, the little girl would be 35 by now, there's no reference, very few references to politics. We can tell that these people are activists. They show up for rallies. They show up to fight the great good fights, and they're there supporting nurses and teachers and anti-war efforts, but in a kind of not specific way. The kids also, I'm sure you noticed, don't have cell phones. They don't have complete,
right,
you know, CIA
that, yeah,
level telecommunications on them at any time like our children do. So there are a lot of ways in which I had to play with the facts so that you didn't notice, so in a annoying, inconvenient way that kids didn't have phones and whatnot. But at the same time, I just had to keep it be a novel that could take place in a number of different eras.
It occurred to me, the cell phones, IMs, and texting.
And iPods.
And iPods, yeah. It's kind of not there, but at the same time, there's room for it if you want to believe it's there.
Well, also, I found when I had a teenager that the whole thing with the cell phones and the iPods is so infuriating that it would just, it's like putting cumin in a recipe, you know, it just becomes a recipe about cumin. It just takes over. And once you have the annoyance of kids with their cell phones and iPods plugged in, and Nintendos, I've got to say, because the one thing that I think I did right as a parent was I never let Sam get a Nintendo, and every single other parent did. And the kids are really badly addicted to video games now and to that level of violence and that trance that a video game creates. So there's no video games in this book either, but that's because once you get into it, the whole thing with the cell phones, when you're a parent, is, oh, I didn't have reception. Oh, the battery had run out. Oh, I left this, you know, and I didn't want this. I wanted this book to be about universal themes that people were writing about 1,000 years ago: family, mess, sickness, how we survive unsurvivable loss, how we grow, how we get free from our parents, how our parents bear us getting free from them, poetry, music, loyalty. I didn't want it to be about cell phones and Nintendo.
Because you banned the Nintendo, did you find that Sam read more than his friends? Or
no, he didn't read more than his friends, but he didn't go into a trance in his bedroom every day when he got home from school. He was always allowed to play him at other people's houses, but he doesn't play him now. He doesn't have one at home, and he's not strung out over video games. And I don't know if this is a sexist or a generalization, but I personally know so many men who hit the video games and can go into the trance for 2 or 3 hours at a time, and it's actually not something Sam does. So for that, I'm really relieved.
Well, Anne Lamott, I was speaking with Carrie Perloff of ACT not long ago, and I asked her a couple of questions about the nature of theater, and she made the comment that more and more plays don't have intermissions and only go for 90 minutes because this entire generation, they don't have the concentration. I mean, on something great like August Osage, they do, but generally they don't. And she said that one thing ACT is doing, you can see it also at Berkeley Rep and other theater companies around the country, is they're creating more multimedia because this younger generation is just simply not into words like we were. Do you think that's true?
I think it's true that they really don't have the concentration. But I have to say that I think it's fantastic to have plays without intermissions and to have 90-minute movies and 100-minute movies. And I find now, because my back is sore a lot of the time and because my butt is sore and my knees are creaky, that I'm very reluctant to go to movies that are more than 2 hours. Now, when I was a younger person and I had a foreign film that was 3 hours or even two different 3-hour movies back to back, I was much more available for that. I think it is true that the adults now, the young adults now, really want you to have them in and out in under 2 hours. And I actually really think that's a great idea.
In your conversations in doing the research, did you notice an almost ADD approach with them, or were they able to focus just as much as you were, you think?
I had 5 girls I could talk to for over time about their lives, but I was really focusing more on their sexual values and activity and their use of drugs and where the use of drugs brought them. And so I really wasn't talking to them quite so much about culture. I talked to them a lot about school so I could create Rosie's High School and classes and teachers and whatnot, but I have to say I didn't really get into that with them.
Specifically in terms of their views towards sexuality, how did those compare very specifically to your own views when you were in your teens and 20s?
Well, as I said, my life, my whole worldview was profoundly altered. With sexual matters, it was like having a birth coach all of a sudden to have the women of the movement encouraging me to have a sense of self that was not derived from having guys like me in a certain way for a certain length of time. And with sex, I mean, I just did all of the things that today's girls do, which is to have unconscious or serial sex, or to service guys, or to try to get guys to love and need me because I can make them so happy. So that's something that is part of the human condition, is wanting to have that sense of power and desirability. But it was very, very tempered by the simultaneous struggle to be the woman that I understood finally by 1970 I was capable of being, huge and juicy and even eclipsing the guys if that was in the natural course of events. Whereas I feel a little bit for Rosie and her friends that they're unwilling to eclipse the men again, the boys again, and that this behavior of wearing such revealing, highly sexualized, kind of pornographic clothes is taking away the life force that they might otherwise use in finding their own sense of giganticness and power. And I cannot stand what the teenage girls are doing for the teenage boys at the parties. It breaks my heart. And I want to be Holden Caulfield. I want to be the catcher in the rye and stand at the cliffs and catch the girls and say, don't do this. This is hurting your spirit. I would say, so what's in it for you? And they would try to explain, as Rosie tries to explain to her mother, it's just not that big a deal. They say over and over again, it's something the mothers are hysterical about. It's really friendly. It's what we do. It's like kissing. It feels good. No, I like to do it. Oh, and the guys are very grateful. Really, the guys are grateful. There's a surprise. So,
Anne Lamott, you finished this book, Imperfect Birds. What do you think you've learned yourself? How has the book changed you in writing it, you think?
I'm not sure the book changed me so much as that I came to see in writing it how far I've come. I've come to see that so many of the values instilled in me by the work I've done on myself, and you know, it's my 12th book, and I've done like 20 full tours, and I raised a child on my own, and now I'm a grandmother, and I've come to see how deeply and profoundly life changes you and grows you, how much more impatient the kids are than I am. It's one of the things that's great about, I was 56 a couple weeks ago. It's just so great to have given up so much stuff. It's like throwing stuff out of the plane that kept me afloat that I thought was just so important and that I really needed to hold on to. And I go, you know what? I'm just so too tired to do that. I got to see also how I've been saved from the multitasking, partly by being an artist in this world. I see that the kids are really afraid of their parents racing around and being gray with the effort to the forward thrust of staying one step ahead and, you know, getting one more errand done and one more good deed done and one more this. And I don't live like that, but I know a lot of the parents feel that they have to because the pressure is on their kids and on themselves. The pressure of living in such a scary, dangerous world with 24/7 news cycles and whatnot has stolen people's lives and plop and flop away from them. And I really think that the plop and the flop is where we are so nourished and where we get our stamina and where we get our sense that life is really precious. You don't get that sense if you're racing ahead, round and round and round looking for parking spaces. You get that sense when you've stopped and when you're breathing and sighing. And I got the sense of, wow, being an artist who is at home and who is going by my own rules and having to come up with the discipline to get a day's work done has given me this precious, precious gift, my core value, which is that we're here to live. We're here to breathe and to dance and to flop and to be practice radical silliness and to hang out with one another. And that is what I most hope people come away with.
Anne Lamott, what are you working on now? Is there going to be another collection of essays coming out soon?
I actually don't really have any idea. No, there won't be a collection of essays, and there certainly won't be another novel anytime soon. They take way too much stamina. But I, right now, at this point, could not say what the next book will look like.
You've been listening to an interview with Anne Lamott, whose latest novel is Imperfect Birds. Grace Eventually, Thoughts on Faith, and her other novels are available in paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.